This is it. You have just pulled off the most successful religious revolution in 1,000 years. But now you have to figure out what comes next. How do you build a church when you've spent the last decade tearing one down? How do you maintain unity among your followers when they start disagreeing about fundamental doctrines? And how do you defend your movement when the Holy Roman Emperor is literally marching towards you with an army? Well, welcome to Martin Luther's next challenge. The awkward transition from successful revolutionary to responsible church builder. When Luther discovered that starting a reformation was the easy part. Organizing it into a coherent, lasting movement while keeping everyone on the same theological page. That was going to take some help. Today we're diving into the 5 crucial years from 1525 to 30 that transformed the Lutheran movement from a protest into Protestantism. Featuring brilliant theologians, bitter arguments over bread and wine, political intrigue, and one of the most important documents in Christian history, written while Luther himself was stuck in hiding, unable to attend the very meeting where his movement's future was being decided. By late 1525, Martin Luther was facing a crisis of credibility. His harsh response to the Peasants' War had alienated many commoners who'd seen him as their champion. Catholic critics were gleefully pointing out that the reformer had sided with oppressive nobles against suffering peasants. Even some of Luther's supporters were questioning whether maybe he had lost his way. But Luther was nothing if not resilient. Instead of retreating into defensive isolation, he doubled down on the work of building a sustainable Protestant church. He realized that if the Lutheran movement was going to survive and thrive, it needed more than just charismatic leadership and stirring pamphlets. It needed structure, education, and systematic theology. Luther's marriage to his Katie, that's Katharina von Bora, in June of 1525, had been a stroke of genius, though it didn't seem that way to everyone at the time. The former monk and former nun modeling Christian marriage sent a powerful message about the legitimacy of clerical marriage and the goodness of family life. Their household became really a living demonstration of Protestant values. But perhaps more importantly, Luther began to understand that he needed help. The movement had grown beyond what one person could manage. And Luther's own temperament, passionate and sometimes explosive, always uncompromising, that wasn't always suited to the delicate work of theological diplomacy and institutional building. That's where a brilliant young man named Philip Melanchthon would prove to be exactly what Luther and the Reformation needed. Philip Melanchthon arrived at the University of Wittenberg in 1518 as just a 21-year-old professor of Greek. He was a humanist scholar, a brilliant linguist, and by all accounts, one of the most gifted academic minds of his generation. He was also about as different from Martin Luther as you could possibly imagine. Luther was passionate and combative. Melanchthon was very calm and diplomatic. Where Luther was a former monk driven by spiritual anxiety, Melanchthon was a refined scholar motivated by intellectual curiosity. Where Luther wielded theology like a battle axe, Melanchthon applied it with surgical precision. When Melanchthon first arrived in Wittenberg, he was actually shorter than expected and looked younger than his years. The faculty was underwhelmed by their new colleague's physical presence, but when he began to lecture on Greek literature and biblical exegesis, it became clear they had acquired a genuine academic superstar. Luther recognized Melanchthon's gifts immediately and began mentoring him in theological matters while learning from him in areas of classical scholarship and educational theory. It was one of history's greatest intellectual partnerships, the passionate reformer and the careful scholar, the medieval monk and the Renaissance humanist, working together to give systematic shape to the Protestant movement. By the mid-1520s, Melanchthon had become Luther's closest collaborator and most trusted theological advisor. Luther affectionately called him Philippus and frequently deferred to his younger colleague's judgment on matters requiring diplomatic finesse. Melanchthon, for his part, revered Luther as his theological father and devoted his considerable talents to defending and systematizing Lutheran theology. Their partnership would prove crucial as the Protestant movement faced its first major internal crisis. The Protestant Reformation had successfully challenged papal authority and established the principle of sola scriptura, that is, scripture alone is the ultimate religious authority. But as various reformers began studying scripture independently, they started reaching different conclusions about important doctrinal questions. The most divisive issue involved the Lord's Supper. Now, everyone agreed that the Catholic doctrine of transubstantiation was wrong. That's the idea that the bread and the wine literally become the body and blood of Christ through the priestly consecration. But the question for Protestants was, what should replace that? Now, Luther maintained that while the bread remained bread and the wine remained wine, Christ nevertheless was truly present in, with, and under the elements. This position, later called consubstantiation by critics, held that believers received Christ's actual body and blood along with the bread and the wine. But other reformers, particularly in Switzerland, were moving in a different direction. Led by Ulrich Zwingli in Zurich, who we'll devote an episode to soon, they argued that the Lord's Supper was purely symbolic. It was a memorial meal where bread and wine represented Christ's body and blood, but contained no special spiritual presence. Now, this wasn't just an academic disagreement. The question touched on fundamental issues. How does God communicate grace to believers? What is the relationship between physical elements and spiritual realities? Can material things truly convey divine blessing? By the late 1520s, this disagreement was threatening to split the Protestant movement just when it needed unity the most. Political pressures were mounting as Catholic forces regrouped, and Emperor Charles V was planning a major offensive against Protestant territories. Now, Philip of Hesse, one of the most important Protestant princes, recognized that disunity among Protestants would be catastrophic if they faced a Catholic military alliance. He decided to convene a theological conference to resolve the sacramental controversy and to forge Protestant unity. Now, the meeting was held at Marburg Castle in October 1529. It brought together the leading Protestant theologians of the day. On one side were Luther and Melanchthon, representing the German Lutherans. On the other were Ulrich Zwingli, representing the Swiss Reformed tradition. Now, the stakes couldn't have been higher. Protestant political survival might depend on theological agreement, and both sides knew it. The debate lasted 3 days and covered 14 different theological topics. On the 13 of these points, the two sides reached agreement. They agreed on justification by faith alone, the authority of Scripture, the rejection of papal supremacy, and most of the other fundamental Protestant doctrines. But on the 14th point, the nature of Christ's presence in the Lord's Supper, they hit an immovable wall. Now, Luther's position was characteristically literal and uncompromising. When Jesus said, "This is my body," Luther insisted he meant exactly what he said. Christ was truly present in the sacrament, and to deny this was to call Christ a liar. Zwingli's position was equally firm, but approached from a different angle. Since Christ's human body had ascended to heaven and was seated at the right hand of the Father, it couldn't be simultaneously present in bread and wine on earth. Therefore, "this is my body" must mean "this represents my body." The theological arguments grew increasingly heated. Luther reportedly took chalk and wrote on the table in Latin, "Hoc est corpus meum," "this is my body," refusing to move beyond the literal interpretation of Christ's words. Zwingli argued that Luther's position made no logical sense and violated basic principles of human nature. How could a physical body be in multiple places at once? Now, Luther responded that Zwingli was applying human reason to divine mystery and limiting God's power by human understanding. The debate revealed a fundamental difference in theological method. Luther prioritized the clear words of Scripture, even when they seemed to contradict human reason. Zwingli insisted that Scripture must be interpreted in ways consistent with rational understanding and natural law. After 3 days of intense debate, it became clear that no agreement was possible. The two sides could unite on almost everything except this one crucial point. But this one point was enough to prevent the political unity and military alliance that Philip of Hesse desperately wanted. Luther's response to the failed negotiation revealed both his theological convictions and his personal limitations. He reportedly told Zwingli, quote, "You have a different spirit than we have," unquote, effectively declaring that the Swiss reformers were not true Christians despite their agreement on 13 out of the 14 points. This harsh judgment reflected Luther's all-or-nothing approach to theological truth. In his mind, if Zwingli was wrong about the Lord's Supper, he was wrong about the gospel itself. There could be no fellowship with those who denied what Luther saw as a clear biblical truth. Well, Zwingli, for his part, was equally disappointed, but perhaps more gracious in his response. He reportedly wept as he left Marburg, recognizing that Protestant disunity would have a tragic political consequence. The failure at Marburg meant that when Protestant territories faced Catholic military presence, they would do so as separate, competing movements, rather than as a unified Protestant alliance. This division would have profound consequences for the political and religious future of Europe. The irony was painful. The Reformation had begun with Luther's call for a unity around biblical truth, but was now fragmenting over competing interpretations of the same biblical truth. While theologians debated sacramental theology, political events were moving rapidly towards a crisis. Emperor Charles V, having dealt with various military threats from France and the Ottoman Empire, was finally ready to turn his attention back to the Lutheran problem. In 1529, the Imperial Diet met at Speyer with a clear agenda: reverse the religious toleration that allowed Lutheran territories to flourish and restore Catholic uniformity throughout the Holy Roman Empire. The Diet's decisions were devastating for Protestant territories. The previous Diet of Speyer in 1526 had allowed each prince to determine religious policy in his own territory, effectively legalizing Lutheranism where local rulers supported it. But in 1529, the Diet revoked this tolerance. The new mandate required all Lutheran territories to return to Catholic practices immediately. No further innovations in worship or doctrine would be permitted. Lutheran pastors would be expelled, Lutheran books burned, and traditional Catholic services restored. For Protestant princes like Frederick the Wise's successor, John the Steadfast, and Philip of Hesse, that meant choosing between their religious convictions and their political survival. Their response was historic. On April 19th of 1529, six princes and 14 imperial cities signed a formal protest against the Diet's decisions. They agreed that matters of conscience could not be decided by majority vote, and they owed obedience to God before they owed obedience to the emperor. The protest gave the Protestant movement its name. The signers became known as Protestants, those who protested against what they saw as an illegitimate attempt to coerce religious belief. But more than a name was at stake. The protest essentially declared that Protestant territories would resist imperial religious policy by force if necessary. The stage was set for armed conflict between Protestant and Catholic forces within the Holy Roman Empire. The emperor responded to the Protestants by, well, we're going to have to wait till the next episode to see how he responded.